right. My name is Alicia Sell. Today is November 8th, 2006. I am interviewing Beatrice Woodson Beale Burwell at her apartment in Elm Park Estates?
Elm Park Estates.
Okay. In Roanoke, Virginia. Okay. And I'm going to start by asking you some background questions. When and where were you born?
In Roanoke, Virginia.
Okay. And if you could just say the year also for the recording. Your birth date.
Beg your pardon?
Can you say your birth date?
My birthday is November the 1st, 1910.
Okay. Can you tell me about your parents, brothers, and sisters?
My mother was named Emma Patterson Woodson. My daddy was named William Thomas Woodson.
Okay. And did you have brothers or sisters?
I had five sisters and three brothers.
Okay. Where did you fall in the...
I'm the baby of the family.
Are you? Okay.
Only one living.
Did your mother or father have brothers and sisters that lived here in Roanoke also?
My mother had a brother.
Okay.
That lived in Roanoke. Her, do you want his name? And his name was Ben Patterson.
Okay. And would you visit with his family at all when you lived here in Roanoke?
Yes. When I lived in Roanoke, I had a very, very large family. And we visited from, and it was a closely knitted family. And I visited, all of us visited our parents all the time. My father had a sister that lived here. So we were always visited.
Was there a particular holiday or a day of the week that you would visit and all get together?
On all holidays, we got together. And we, anytime anything happened to anybody in the family, all of us were there. So.
Okay. Can you describe your home life, for instance, for us?
Well, I was blessed to have been raised in a Christian home where my father was really a man with a mission. And his mission was he's going to see to it that his children had advantages that he didn't have. He was wrapped up in politics. And every time anybody was running for any office in Roanoke, he would have those people to come over. And he organized the blocks. And he would have them to come over and talk to the people in the community. He was really a man with a mission.
What did your father do for a living?
He worked before I was born and until he retired, he worked for the North and Western Railroad.
Okay. Did your mother work?
No, she was, she worked. She worked very hard, but she was a stay-at-home mother.
Okay. Do you remember things about your house? For instance, do you remember listening to the radio or when you got your first telephone?
I remember when we got our first radio. I remember when we got our first television. And I remember when we got our first car. It was a T-model Ford. And they had to get out in the front of it and crank it up and jump out of the way so if it's jumped, the car would kind of jump. And they whoever's standing in front would kind of jump too. And that was really a sensation when we got that T-model Ford.
Do you remember what year that was? Do you remember right around the year that you got that car?
I was very young. I guess I had just started school. But I don't remember what year.
Okay. What kind of activities did you participate in when you were younger?
You name it. And I participated in it. I was very, very active in elementary school. And it's hard, and you really can't separate. When I went to school, the family and the church and the community, we really did work as one. I respected my neighbors just like I did my mother and father, because I knew what would happen if I didn't. And that's the one thing that I think about so often, how it was a community, because as you know where I'm coming from, everything was segregated then. So the colored people were very close together. And I could give you one example of if you would like to hear it.
Please.
I remember very distinctly, and it's one of the things that has stayed with me all my life and has helped to mold my life. Before I started school, my mother took all of us to Norfolk, Virginia, when the soldiers had to go to World War I. I was very, very young. Everybody was crying. A whole group went down from Roanoke. Everybody standing there crying. I was crying too, because I didn't realize the impact of what was going on. But anytime my mother cried and everybody else crying, I cried my heart out. But my brother, my mother had been married before, and he was old enough to go to the World War I. And I can see right now this huge ship and nothing on it but soldiers. And as far as they went out in the ocean, everybody standing there crying and waving. And I can see right now that ship, and I can see my mother crying. And that has had an impact on me all my life, because I felt the love. I felt the togetherness. And when I came back, the people in my church, especially First Baptist Church, started knitting socks and gloves, and they made all these things, and they sent them to, they take them downtown somewhere, I don't know where, Red Cross, I guess, and they would mail them, and the people would make bonnets, and they made aprons that came all the way, you know, a full apron, and they sold that to make the yarn to buy to do this knitting with, and it was such love, it's such bonding together. And I had that feeling all my life of people being bonded together and loving and doing and caring.
It's wonderful. Did you have family stories that were passed down in your family from one generation? For instance, did your family have memories about the Civil War or slavery, or did you have family recipes that you passed down?
I had a dollar gold piece, and it's beautiful. It has the work all around it, and that was given to my father. My grandfather was a slave, and that was given to my daddy, and that was given to me, and I have it now. Wonderful. And I cherish that so much so that one time they had an exhibit in Washington, and a gold, and somebody there, I was wearing it, and somebody asked me, would I let them put on exhibit? And I said, could you guarantee that, you know, nothing would happen to it? And they said they could guarantee it 99.9%, because when they put things in these cases, if anybody tried to raise it, it would make an alarm. But I didn't give it, because it's just so precious. And then I stopped wearing it, because everybody that see me would want to buy it. So I stopped wearing it. But it is in a safe place now. I don't even keep it out, you know.
What chores did you have to do around the house or in your neighborhood?
Well, all of us had something. We worked together, and we would do what the work we had to do, and our joy was to do our work. We worked together, then we relaxed together, and we would get up and do whatever we had to do. Maybe my job was to Well, I'll back up. My daddy was a strict person on things. A girl is made of sugar and spice and everything nice. And he saw me one time trying to cut some wood. He had a fit. He said, "You don't cut wood. You a girl. Go in and help your mother make a pie or read a book or try to write a poem." I never cut grass in my life. That's the effects of my daddy. He strictly believed in a girl was dainty. A girl didn't do this. A girl didn't do the other. A girl, and I brought that up in my children. A girl doesn't do this. If I ever see you dancing on the floor and a man has a hat, you're going to be embarrassed. Unless you tell him to take it off. If you don't tell him to take it off, I'm going to walk up and take it off. So you don't want to be embarrassed. So don't you dance with anybody with a hat on. I was brought up that way. You know what I mean? We had values. And if you would read sometimes when you have time, what I wrote about it. In school, the teachers were dedicated. All the teachers I had. And as I gave an example, we were taught to love. I had the old desks sent from the white school. We had the old books. But the teacher would say, "You're smart." That's all I ever heard. And you know, they really had me believing I was smart. And because I believed it, they put that in us. They taught patriotism. You could be singing a song. The Negro National Anthem is hymn now. But it was the Negro National Anthem. We'd stand up. And if we weren't standing straight and singing, she would stop the singing and say, "Aren't you proud?" And we say, "Yes, ma'am." And said, "Well, sing like it. Stand tall. You're tall. You're somebody." They put that in us. So I wasn't afraid to face the world because it was put in to my family. They put it in me. "You're Woodson. You're proud. You're smart." And I really did believe I was smart. And that's why I tried to motivate my children when I taught. I can do anything. And I said, on my tombstone, they can even put "You weren't afraid to try." And my daddy had prayer. He was a man of prayer. And when I was real little, I remember getting down on my knees. And all of us had to get down. And he would pray. And I would smell the rolls cooking and all that good stuff. And we would be down and maybe hitting each other on the table. But when we got old enough, then we prayed. We had to do that. We'd never left going on a vacation. I never left going to college, anywhere. Anything happened, he would have all of us in. And when my mother died, my mother was living with me at the time she died. And we were just carrying on, hooping and hollering and carrying on. My daddy walked in. He said, "Y'all stop at hollering. We're going to get down on your knees and we're going to pray." And that reinforced my faith. I said, anybody that can pray in a time like this. And he prayed the most beautiful prayer I ever heard. And he thanked God that he had answered Mama's prayer, because her prayer was that she would not die until all her children were grown and able to take care of themselves. And he thanked God for answering Mama's prayer and for the beautiful life that she lived. And ever since then, anybody die, we get down the family, and we have that prayer. But when you can pray, when things go like that, and you can, I said, I wonder if he's in shock. He gonna give, or thank God, and Mama's dead. But when he prayed, he was saying, taking the weight of the house off of us. And she was, as you can tell, a beautiful woman. And he thanked her for her beautiful life that she lived. And they are the things that molded me.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite? What's your favorite childhood memory?
One Christmas we were peeping, at one of them, and saw my mother with this beautiful colored doll, the largest one we ever got. And she looked up and she saw us, but she didn't say anything. So then the next morning we were acting, and she told us, you know. So that really did take something out of the Christmas, because we believed in Santa Claus till then. But see, we got, you know how kids talk and they say that it's your mama doing this. And we, my mother, I always lived on Gilmer Avenue. And my mother and my daddy took, putting things under the tree, and we peeped over the banister. And I was so excited. I think when I saw that doll, my sister and I were very close together. I had other sisters, too, but it was one, and I guess I should have named them, because we did, you know, work. But they were grown just about, my mother married her first husband when she's 18 years old. And so that family, but we were still, we were all connected, but they were just about grown then. So that's why I didn't name them as sisters. But that's what I never will forget that.
Do you remember how old you were?
I really wouldn't know the age. I was still believing in Santa Claus, so I was very young. Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. Did you and your sister share the doll?
Yeah.
Did you?
Because they bought this one doll, but we were so close, and we shared the same bedroom. So it was easy for us to share.
You said you always lived on Gilmer Avenue. What was your house number? Do you remember?
309.
309 Gilmer Avenue. Mm-hmm. Can you?
I tell you another childhood thing,
please,
that I remember? They, you know, our parents really protected us. I never remember ever going home when my mother wasn't there from school, and when I was coming up, every girl had played the piano. My sister was really an accomplished musician. My brother could play a piano. My brother finished, I'm jumping one thing to the other because you will edit this anyway, won't you? My brother was at Meharry. He finished medicine. He's a pharmacist. His senior year, my sister had last year was at Virginia State College, and my first year was at Wilberforce University. He had three of us in college in one year, and he did it. But he saved all during the year. And his motto was invest in land, have some land, invest in land. And that was one thing that was embedded in him, have something for yourself. And he invested in land. And it, all of us are still being benefited from the land that he invested. He owned land in Orange Avenue, and he owned land almost from Runnel down through Bedford. He bought land from Runnel all the way almost to Christiansburg. And it just happened that land really did pay off that he bought. They were in good spots.
And that was your brother, the pharmacist, who? Who owned it, and what was his name?
That was my brother that finished my hair. His name was Samuel Woodson.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So that was one thing. Another thing, somebody moved in the block. When I got married, I moved to 730 Gilmer. It's a corner house. And my daddy came up. He said, I see you have some new neighbors. Said, did you go and welcome them to the block? I said, no. He said, well, that was wrong. You should go always. When people move in the block, go and welcome them. And I can tell you something else about my daddy. He paid his water, I think it was the water bill, every single day, on the same day, for 30 years. He never missed paying that water bill. And when he didn't come down one day, the man downtown called to see if he was sick. And I heard Reverend James say so often, if he had a bill to pay, he would say, well, I don't have any money now, but if you wait till the first day, New Year's Day, I will have it, because I know Deacon Woodson will be here. And my daddy always went to him. In fact, he got up early. It was a custom then. I told you I use it, any of those words. Black people, colored people, or Negro, whatever. All the men would come. And another thing, on New Year's Day, a lot of women didn't want a woman to come to the house. Did you ever live through that? And that's still in me. I don't visit on New Year's Day. I go to a dinner, the family dinner, because I didn't know what people had were sensitive about it. All the women in the world could come to me on New Year's Day because I like people and I like to be with them. And I'm not superstitious about anything. And then another thing that's so different. Now, we often laugh and say when anybody had a baby, you could see, go walk down the street, and you see diapers, lines of white diapers, pure white. I mean, the way they could keep them. Now, these young people don't know what you're talking about if you said diaper. Another thing, what I started to say, my Alice and Margaret Roberts, all of us came up together, and her mother would have us to come up there, and she taught us crocheting, some crocheted and how to embroidery. Then they'd come down to Mama's house, and we'd crochet and do things like that, and we'd go to the Coleman's house and do things. In other words, our parents didn't turn us loose. When we just didn't get out, and it's the saddest thing for me now to go in this classroom and see first grade children, maybe 10 or 15 up there with a key around their neck. That's my telephone, but I'll just let it ring. With a key around their neck. And after school, a lot of them be just little, I mean, first and second grade. And I say, you're not supposed to be here. You're supposed to be go home right after school. And I said, why don't you go home? They said, well, it's nobody there, and I just hate to be by myself. And their parents would leave crackers or potato chips or something out on the table. And they would go in and get something, a snack, and be there by themselves. I've never. In fact, our parents just didn't let us get out and go. And another thing, if we were on program, this is something that stands out with me. If you were on a program at church or anywhere, they would, if you weren't going to say anything but good morning or good afternoon, I hope you enjoyed the program, they were there. You on program, you were there. Now, I used to chaperone children for parties, and I say, who's going to pick you up? And someone would say, my mother told me to find somebody coming my way. That's elementary school now. Find somebody coming my way. And my mother, I went to very few parties. Our parents didn't let us go to parties. We're coming back to this girl stuff. And my lady next door to me had a party next door, and my mother went as one of the chaperones. Next door. I said, Mom, what in the world you think I'm going to be doing? But that just shows you were protected, and your church looked after you, and the people were concerned, you know? The doctors were dedicated. Mm-hmm. So it was just, you know, something.
That's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Let's go back for just a second, and if you could just tell me a little bit about your house on Gilmer that you grew up in. Was it brick, or was it one story, or was it two stories?
It was a ranch-style house, and the Delta sorority called it the Delta House because the rooms were very, very large, and I had an extra lot, and it was a corner house, so we could have our parties. We didn't have to worry about disturbing people. And we didn't know what it was to go home after a dance. Well, sometime back, all sororities and fraternities used to have a formal dance every spring. And the Deltas would like to come. Sometimes when the Deltas had a regional meeting with their chapter from Bluefield, West Virginia, or Lynchburg, they'd always have it at my house because the rooms were so large. And it could accommodate all those people.
And that was the house you grew up in?
That's when I married, I moved.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about the house you grew up in?
It was a large two-story house. And all of us had our own bedroom. But see, my daddy was very fortunate because he had a good job at Northern Western. And he made a decent salary all the time we came up. So we were really... Bliss, you know what I mean? I don't ever remember my daddy not being able to pay a bill when it was due. Then my daddy started us out with a little Christmas saving. It was maybe, I don't mean it was over 5 or 10 cents a week, you know, Christmas saving. Because it might be $25 you get for Christmas or $50 for it. I know, I'm sure it wasn't over $50. But my daddy would take that and put it in a saving account for us, and he would give us whatever we had saved, you know. So it was just a custom that every payday you save something. I mean, you see, as you understand, his daddy was a slave. His daddy was free six years before my daddy was born. But at that time, it was same as slavery for those people. So it just came up in something, have something for yourself. It was just embedded in us. And we did. We tried to have something for ourselves.
Do you remember your grandfather's name? Who was the slave?
He was named Philip.
Philip.
We looked up the family history, and it went on back, and my father had 8 or 9 brothers. And then, so that's the way that went.
Okay. Let's see. How has Gainsboro changed over the years?
Gainsboro has changed completely. My daddy's first house was on Gainsboro. And that house was passed down to the family. And I'm the last one living in the family. And so I got that house. When they started this renovation, they took that house. And that was a very sad experience for me, because he had it before I was born, and he rented out for a long time. In fact, I rented out when I had it, and when the city took it, and it was right up from Gainsboro, about the third house up, going up that hill, and they took that house and gave me $800. That's what they paid for my house. My sister had a 2-story house next door. That was passed down to her. And because my uncle left that house to her, to my mother, and my mother left it to her. Because I, you know, it had the other. She got $800, beautiful 2-story house. It was beautiful. $800. And, you know, $800. And of course, I bought it, but you can't, you know, but I got $800. And they said, well, they didn't want a house. I said, well, I did. And they said they just wanted the land. But they took it. Mm-hmm. But I didn't, I don't harbor hate, not any of that kind of stuff, because I was brought up. And let me tell you something else. When I was in school, the ministers, the churches had revivals. Do you know whenever they had revivals, the pastor could bring the evangelist to the school? And at Gainsboro, we didn't have anywhere. We would have we had a seminar out in the yard. And the evangelist would come in. We had service in the yard. Reverend James, he was a pastor, first pastor for 38 years. I was baptized with him. He married me. He baptized me. He baptized my husband. He did all those kind of things. I mean, he was the man of one of the outstanding men of the day. Well, anyway, he would bring the evangelists up, and they would have revival service on the yard, and all the children in our class, they would tell them, and Reverend would all emphasize, I don't want you to say you want to join a First Baptist Church. We're not for that. We want you to love Jesus Christ. And they would, the man would preach. And you would take the names of all, they ask anybody that loved Jesus, they would go home and talk to their parents and tell the parents they wanted to join a church, any church. And he advised them to go to church that the parents went to. And we would take down those names that went up to say they wanted to join a church. And the next day, we would check on them to see if they went. And we had devotions every day. Every day started with prayer. And all that has had an effect in who I try to be today.
That's wonderful. Mm-hmm. So you started talking about school a little bit. Tell me where you went to school. Which elementary school did
you go to? I went to Harrison School. Okay. That's where I started. I went to Booker T. And in that book, if you're going to read it, that paper I wrote, that tells you what I participated in when I was in two.
Okay.
And one, I remember going to Virginia State College when my sister was there going to school. I won the contest for the art talker contest. Because, see, I tell you, my parents, you know, had me believing I could do anything. And I won that contest, and they sent me to Virginia State. And my sister was so proud. The church was so proud. The community was so proud. But now, child, I can win something. And I've seen parents come in school in May and want something about the child. And I said, well, who's teacher? Someone didn't even know the name teacher. Never be in May now. Child been in that class in September. But that's another whole story.
And what high school did you go to?
Addison. As I said, my class was the first class I went there. I went to Booker T. Washington. Booker T. Washington. That school they still use it for headquarters. Now, it was up on the hill. My daddy had all this land all back there and everywhere. Mm-hmm.
And you said you went to college?
I went to Wilberforce University. It's in Wilberforce, Ohio.
Okay. And you got a degree in education?
Yes, in education. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And did you get a master's degree or just your bachelor's degree?
I went to school. I've always go to summer school. And so many children were so far behind. I took every course in reading. I had enough hours for a master's. But I got I was called a reading specialist. I took every course in reading. I'd go in that room. I said, you going to read? Alice Turner was my principal at Harrison School. Mr. Sidney was my principal, you know, too. Lucy Addison was my principal when I was in elementary school. Lucy Addison was my principal. I scared death of her. And she'd walk, honey, everybody start, what you call. And my husband finished Lucy Addison. And he said she tried to whip those big boys, they'd hold the hand way up here. She's short, and they'd hold the hand where the thing would slide off. They tell tales about her. But she did have a respect. We scared death of her. Very small in stature, but it was her personality and that stern look and everything, you know.
So she was your principal?
She was my first principal.
Wow. And your husband, can you say his name?
Hmm?
What was your husband's name?
He was the one that I married and went to Washington because he was an assistant principal of high school in Washington. But he was a runner too. And...
what was his name?
Lawrence.
Lawrence.
Mm-hmm. That's when I got Bill Burwell. But people in Roanoke call me Bill. Nobody calls me Burwell in Roanoke. Because, see, when I married, I went to Washington. And I got on to teach there. In fact, the man hired me before I moved there. And so, anyway, being in the sorority and him being the principal, and he was the principal of the first year they integrated in Washington. So you know what he went through. But anyway, it was exciting. And I enjoyed it. And then the other high schools would send us tickets to go to the reunions, school reunions, or where he taught. So I was going somewhere all the time. Because he taught chemistry and math in the high school for a long time, Armstrong High School. Then they made him assistant principal. So I had a full, beautiful life.
What did you teach?
I taught sixth grade.
And all
elementary
the subjects?
School. I was always in elementary school. I taught sixth grade at Harrison School. Oh, and I got the Teacher of the Year and all that kind of stuff. But I have plaques. Oh, that will fill these walls. But that plaque that means the most to me, I get letters from my students, and they will come and they will tell me, and these are the plaques in my heart. Some will come and say, you showed me the right way, or you helped me to do this. Now, they are the plaques that I cherish, and they're the ones that's in my heart. And I had so many inner, I taught a boy in the sixth grade. And I was looking to see that what time it was.
It's 11:30.
A good time. This boy, you talking about a handsome fella. He was so handsome. He always had his head down like this. He was on welfare, which is all right. But it was so unfair. He came to me one day. He said, "Would you let me go home?" I said, "Ask the principal." He said, "She won't let me go home." And I said, "Well, are you sick or something?" He said, "No." I said, "Why do you want to go home?" He said, "Because my mother got her check today. And if I don't get home today, she won't have money to buy me shoes tomorrow." And said, he had on some girl shoes. And the children teased him. And I'd walk down the aisle, he'd have his head in. I'd take my hand, raise his head up. I said, "If I was a good-looking person like you, I'd be walking in the aisle." That's the way I talked to him. Do you know that boy got to be up the highest rank in the Army? Mm-hmm. And he tell me all the time, said, I never did understand something of him. And said, "But you gave me confidence in myself." Now, that's a plaque in my heart. He went right on up. You don't tell a child, usually, they're good looking. At least I never told a fella. I said, "You just handsome." He was sure. But see, he had such an inferiority complex. I worked on his inferior complex as much as I did trying to teach him my adjective for my adverb. Because you're teaching a person. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And he just bought some night. But see, he got himself a job and was able to buy things for himself. So I guess he thought he's ugly, head down all the time. And I'd go in the seminary, and the teacher would come in with the children. And when I see somebody with the head down, and I'd go to the social worker. We had a good counselor in Washington. I said, "What's that girl's name?" I said, "Something wrong. She's always coming in with her head down." And what happened? They were coming in, and all of the children had on uniforms. They were uniforms where I taught dark blue skirts, a dark blue jumper, and a gold blouse. And I said, "You take this money and buy her two outfits, one skirt and a top to go with it, and a jumper." I said, "But don't tell anybody, you know, where it came from." And I bought a lot of things. I believe in tithe, and I take money out of my tithe. And then one thing I liked about Sears and Roebuck, they would sell their shoes. The council would may take four or five children to down and buy shoes for them. And Sears and Roebuck would sell them good stout shoes for what they said they paid for them themselves. And I said, "Well, I'm going to put money in the shoe bank." And I went to one lady. I said, "You know, I noticed that whenever it's snowing or raining or real, real bad weather, your kids are out of school, two girls." And I said, "If you tell me it's none of my business," I said, "I will not be hurt." I said, but "because in a way it's not my business, in another way it is my business." And I said, "I would like to buy them boots." And I gave her money to buy boots, or galoshes, or whatever you call them, for her two girls. And so I was thinking that I hadn't priced any boots for children or anything. I just gave her what I paid for mine for her to buy. I gave her twice that much. She bought both of them, what's called, and gave me the money back. I said, "How in the world could you get them that cheap?" But anyway, I gave her the money back. I said, "Well, you buy them two pair of shoes because it's not raining, snowing all the time." So, and I gave it back to her. And I said, "Don't you ever tell the girls that I gave it to you. Because if I asked the girls to go to the store for me or something, they would feel they'd have to do it." And she never told them, you know, where it came from. I like to do things, and I don't like saying things about it. I don't like for anything to be said.
Okay. Well, we're almost done. I have just a few questions about Gainesboro specifically, about the community. What businesses and shops did your family go to? Do you remember?
What business?
Where would you go shopping, or were there places you would go in Gainesboro to do that?
I forgot to tell you that my mother's brother was named Bale, and He had a store at the corner of Gainsborough. I got that on those notes I have. And he made enough from that store at the corner of Gainsborough and was it Harrison or Rutherford? One of those corners. And he made enough selling at that store to support his family. He bought a house and support his family. And we bought a lot of things from, most of the things from him. In the meantime, in Roanoke, they couldn't have raised hogs and all that kind of stuff on where we lived. But they could, somebody way over where they back of where they had Booker T. School, they could raise it way back over there. And so my dad always had somebody to raise them from him. And then some of the places that sold food and things, they would, what was left, my daddy would go by and pick it up and take it over there to the man that raised, you know, these hogs for him. And then on the corner of where I was raised up as a child, it's called Dillard's. They had a store right on the corner across the street. And then on the next block at the corner, it was a meat shop. Then we had the market was in full bloom then. And you could take $1 or $2 and I'd go to the down on the market. I'd bring back all the cabbage and the beans and the, everything I could hold. And you could take $1 or $2 and do it. So it was the stores in the community. And then we would always, as I told you, work together in the mornings, clean the house and whatever. Then we would change clothes and go to the front porch. That was the pride of our life, go to the front porch. But at that time, the people on the market that sold peaches, for instance, if they didn't sell them all, they'd come on the streets hollering. But the, you know what they had to sell? And my mother, oh, she was really, I don't see how she did all she did. She would buy them. She said, how many bushels of peaches do you have? He said, 4 bushels. Let you have 50 cents a bushel. Mom would buy all 4 of them. Then she said, okay, y'all take your clothes off because we had work clothes. And we'd have to go in and start peeling peaches and something. And a lot of times we'd go out on the porch. We said, Lord, don't let anybody come by selling. But that's the way she maneuvered. And that's the way we had everything because she knew how to manage, you know.
Would everyone in the neighborhood go out and hang out on their porches in the evening?
Yeah, in the evening, yeah. And sometimes when it'd be so very hot, my parents had a big two-story house. It was about 8 or 10 rooms in that house. Well, anyway, sometimes it'd be so hot upstairs that my mother said, well, you can stay up later tonight. We'd go out. We had, all of us had a lot of land with our houses. And we'd go out and put the chairs, yard chairs, between the two houses, and the neighbors would come, and we'd be out there, and it was so nice. I wasn't afraid. I was never afraid. It wasn't anything to be afraid of, because we looked out for each other. And I remember when my first husband died, Alice Turner, my principal, would send somebody from the school, and she would take the class. This teacher would come down for 2 hours, and the principal would take the class. And then another principal would come down, another teacher would come down, and somebody would take the class, or maybe a class would double the class. And I was never by myself. And you know, a long time ago when I came up, and you knew when anybody died, it just spread in the whole neighborhood. We were bonded together because we were all on this side of the railroad track. We didn't go on the other side. Except for business or something like that. But anyway, they always hung a wreath outside the door. Anybody that you pass by, you'd see a wreath. And then they brought the people home when they died, the night before the funeral, and somebody would stay up all night long with whoever in the family stayed up all night long. And they never, somebody was sitting right there in that room, and people bring coffee in and donuts, and that's the way we lived then.
Do you remember Gainsborough Library when that opened?
Yes, and I remember Virginia Lee. But come back to Gainsborough School. I never saw a Potbelly school stove.
Oh, yes.
When I was in going to school, they didn't have those. We had the regular furnace. But when my first year teaching in Roanoke was in Gainesboro, and I looked in there and I said, what in the world is this? But we had a janitor, and he would come in every so many hours and put coal. There's never coal in that school. They really kept those rooms because coal, I think, gives off more heat than anything you can heat with anyway. But nobody wants coal now because it's too dirty and everything. But that was my first experience in looking at a potbelly stove. And Queen Williams was the principal. That's her. That's that old school with the faculty. I thought that y'all like to see. And I enjoyed what you call them, but the school, as I say, you couldn't separate it from the church. And you couldn't separate the church from the community. Now, to give you an example, the Bible Band Missionary Circle. I guess I came up almost before I was born because my mother was one of the first members of the Bible Band at First Baptist Church. And whenever anybody was sick, they had hours they'd go at night. And when my mother would go at night, she would take us, the girls, with her. And I'd be sitting up in a chair asleep. But my mother, that's the last woman that I went to see with my mother, because Ella Butcher, you know the Butchers, she died. And when she died, I was there that night before she died, sitting up in a chair. I remember sleeping. And my mother, when I went to sleep, I remember my mom at her bedside doing something for her. Now, we couldn't go to the hospital. So the church was the hospital. The members would stay up all night long with you. But we live in a different society now. Everything is different. I've seen the world turned upside down. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember strong community leaders in Gainesboro that you remember?
I remember Undertaker Hughes. He was about 100 years old. He was, if he wasn't 100, he's mighty close to, because I remember everybody talking about, well, you know, he's almost 100. I don't know, I don't remember whether he reached that 100 or not, but I know he must have been mighty close to it. He had a Undertaker shop on Gainesboro. Gainesboro was a very popular street, and Henry Street was a very popular street. I remember Dr. Brooks, that was a pharmacist on Henry Street. I remember Dr. Robinson, that was a pharmacist on Gainesboro. And my daddy was young at heart. And I'd take him over to Henry Street, and he would go in that drugstore on Henry Street, right in the main block, and talk to this doctor there. I'd take him there all the time. And it's because my dad, as I say, he was in politics till the day he died. One time I went, and I'm rambling because I'm just telling you as I think about it. I went down to my daddy's house. He lived at 309. That's where I lived until I got married. And when I moved to 730, my daddy said, B, did you get a car from Poff today? Poff was something other than Washington. And he said, what did you do with it? Poff would write a card or send a letter, a card or something to everybody. He said, I'm more mail than anybody I know of. And he said, what did you do? I said, I put it in trash. He said, you should not have done that. He said, I want you to see this letter that I got from Poff. And Poff told my daddy, Poff, P-O-F-F, that he was the most dedicated person that he had ever met. And if all his constituents were as dedicated as he was, my daddy never got any mail that he didn't answer. I put mine in the trash. And he said, you don't do that. He said, it means something to show that you are patriotic, that you love your country. And that's when I have voted every year. My daddy worked to help abolish poll tax. And I tell you this, I went to Wilberforce. It's time, everything's segregated. All right, I got a pass. My daddy could get a pass because he worked at Northwest. I was on the train, and a conductor came by, and he looked at that pass. He said, you're not supposed to be on this train. I said, why? He said, it's a number. But you realize at that time of segregation, the conductor was staying on the outside of the coach. And if you were colored, he would tell you to go to the right. That was the train, the one next to the engine, where it was the noisiest and dirtiest. And they'd send you that. All right. So anyway, I was on the train. And the conductor said, "You're not supposed to be on this." He said, I said, "Why?" He said, "This number said not good on train." I make up the number. I said 7, because trains had numbers. And I said, "Well, I've been riding it all the time." He said, "Listen," said, "I'm not a racist." That's what the conductor said. And he said, "I would rather see you get off at the, we're going through West Virginia, Berkeley, West Virginia, somewhere or another. Wintertime now, Christmas, I'd come home for Christmas. I'd rather see you get off, because when the next man come on, the conductor, he'll put you off anywhere, because you're not supposed to be on here." That were about 15 of us from Wilberforce. At one time, we had about 15 here. That we had a Wilberforce club. Judge, you know Dillard. Did you know Dillard? Did you? He got to be a judge. He went to Wilberforce and Arthur Spence and all them. Well, anyway, we had about 15. They lived in Newport News and Portsmouth, and all them know. They said, "Well, if she gets off, we getting off." All 15 got off that train. The train, he knew the thing was closed, the station. He said, "And I'm going to call and tell them that I'm stopping the train there, because there's some people to get on." And all of us got off in the wintertime, snowing, cold, because you know it's cold in Ohio. And we got off that train by 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. All of us 15 standing outside the thing, and had stand out. My daddy, he called, I guess he went to everybody. I met him, he was president of the United States, I met him. He said, "I will die fighting that you'll never be put off again." That law was changed. That law was changed, showing how what politics did. You got to go through the system. Only way you get anything changed is by voting. From that time on, they didn't put any discrimination. It wasn't a race discrimination, no, it was anybody that couldn't ride certain trains. From that day, my daddy worked. He wrote to his congressman. He went to the city. He went all the way up. And that law was changed. That shows you of what persistence will do. So those things are, you know, kind of in me, because I'm a fighter. I worked in the, I got pictures in there of Clinton. They had sent me personal autograph, and Hillary Clinton wrote me a letter. I wish I tried to find that letter. I got some things up in there. I stuck in the book, because I said, and then I can't reach the book. So I was trying to find that letter. When she wrote this book about It Takes a Whole Village, and asked me would I write about my school days for her to put in that book. I didn't do it, but I wasn't in town then. I was really having myself a ball. And and when I got back, the deadline had passed, way passed. Because, see, I went to Delft Convention and I left that at the convention for a week. Then I went from the convention to a cruise. I was away another week. Then I stopped by my godchild's, my campus daughter, for another week. I got back. It was too late, but the deadline had passed. But I regret that I didn't, because I could have answered and said I was, out of town and the deadline had passed when I got the letter. But to tell you the truth, when I got back, I said, "Oh, they're writing for some money or something." I don't think I even read it then until maybe another week.
Well, the time's almost done, but is there anything else that we didn't cover that you would like to share with us?
Well, I just wish that my parents were living in C. Oh, let me tell you about my grandson. He is a model. The only people that could go in Hot Springs Hotel were the ones working there. They called him about a month ago. He's up there modeling. Somebody from that, Yeah, I wish I had. That's his picture. He finished right there. He finished VPI. He finished VPI. He got a good job in Richmond. He wouldn't give up his job. And he was modeling. I wish you had time to see these pictures. He was modeling. He wasn't thinking about modeling. And he was in a store looking at something. And a man came by. He was trying to, when he went to Richmond, he got in a little apartment. He's been there 5 or 6 years, and he has been promoted right on up, right on up, right on up. Now he has bought a house in Richmond. And so anyway, I show you how the world has turned upside down. When my girls went to school, they went to Patrick Henry. Do you know for a time the police had to escort the bus to Patrick Henry? Because not only were the children fighting every day, parents were out with things to fight. And they were escorted every day. Well, see, that's the difference in my school. I never had a word fear. I never had a word dope. I don't think I ever heard the word dope. I want to learn. And you know what I want to do now? And I'm going to write, I regret I didn't write to here because I might have to write to her. I want to find out now. I'm curious. I want to know. Now, I was told by mouth, I'm going to check it, that we got the word Negro because when after slavery, at Congress or somebody, this is by word of mouth handed down, said, what are we going to do with those people? And what they don't even have a name. What are we going to call them? And I was told by mouth coming down, mouth to mouth, that Congress passed a law that we would be named called Negroes. I'm going to find out who named us. Why did you name us that? Who named us African American? I think that might have been by popular demand. But I want to go back. That's my project now. I want to find out how did we get that name? If I can't find you could do get that. Do you know why did Congress pass that law?
I will find out.
Huh?
I will find out.
That word of mouth. That's what I was told. But I'm curious.
I'll look it up.
And I want to live. I want to find out everything. My son said, "Mama, you ought to see what's on the board now." He worked for the, my son attended Hampton, and he worked in telephone company here. He's wrapped up in all this stuff. He's really wrapped up in everything. And he's still, anytime they have a course offered at Virginia Western, in anything by computers, and he's talking about things, and when I was living in Washington, I never forget, he came and said, "Mom," said, "come on, it's something other." He wanted to get something by the internet or computer or something. And so I rode with him to Maryland. So I went out there with him, and he said, I asked the man, they were talking, he was talking to the clerk. I didn't know what they were talking about. They had a language all their own. So I said, "Well, do you have a TV? He said, "No." I said, "We don't carry TVs. That's low tech." I said to myself, "That's low tech, and I don't understand." I don't understand low tech, but it was something out there. I didn't even know what they were talking about, that language, you know, just like crocheting. That crocheting, you know, has a language of its own. And anyway, that's what he's wrapped up in it. Now, when he used to work with Boy Scouts, and he's wrapped up in Spanish. He was in high school, and he would take the Scouts, and he's gotten every permit, I guess you call him permit, to talk on ham or something, whatever it is. He can talk to everybody overseas. And he would bring a lot of Scouts that's interested in Spanish. And he would call Spain, and those kids would talk to people in Spanish. Oh, that he did all that for a while. But it's life is just interesting. And I just want to live to be 100. Because I want to see all my children and their children. I have, you know, grandchildren. All of my grandchildren call me Mom B because I told myself, now look at one thing I regret. I was trying to be young, you know, so I put my age back. And when I went to Washington, my second year there, the principal sent in this thing and recommended me for the teacher, elementary teacher of America. My name is in that book twice. And when I got the book, I looked at Haiti in there. I finished Ashland High School in 1929. I got my magic marker, because he had to put my age back, and marked like that 29. I got this, I got that, I got this. And they put my name on the trophy for the Urban League for being outstanding something. A senior citizen or something I got it for, something. And the name, my name's on the trophy. They keep in national headquarters or something. But all that doesn't matter. But anyway, I put the black marker and scratched out every name, every date. I'm so sorry I did that. Because, you know, man, I can stand on the hilltop and holler, I'm 96.
Yeah.
But take that one time, I put it back, you know. And then I got scared one time. I said, they tell me, they say, if you put your name back on the driving permit, they can take your driving permit. So I put it right on the driving permit. They can take it and not give you one. They can stop you from getting one. They tell me, see, because you say everything is true. So I put the, when I was old, when my son was born, I was married 8 years before he was born. And the doctor told me, say, you cannot carry a child. And I was so little, you know, trying to be cute. But anyway, he was a premature baby. He was born 7 months. I'll show you how God is. That child slept for those other 2 months. You wouldn't know a baby's in that house. He just slept. And the day he's supposed to be born, he started crying as a newborn baby. Uh-huh. But anyway, I scratched. You ought to see that book. And then I said, Lord, if I had that to do over, I wouldn't do that. But you have most sense. But you don't go this way but once. So I tell everybody, you go this journey one time, so just make it a good one. And that's what I'm trying to do now. I pray every day that I would put a smile on somebody's face before I go to sleep at night. That's my prayer.
Ms. Beal Verwell, this is Carla Lewis at the Gainsborough Branch Library, and we're here in your home. And I just wanted to thank Ms. Virginia Woolf for telling me about you. And thank you so very much for interviewing for us.
Oh, this is
such a pleasure.
I'm glad y'all came up.
Oh, we are just happy to do it.
It was wonderful, because I can look back. Oh, I was crowned Miss Allen. You remember Cubby Gill? He crowned me. I was crowned Miss Addison. And he gave me this long bunch of red roses out on the football field. I thought I was hot stuff. At the intermission of the football game, I had somebody, he escorted me to the middle of the field. And somebody put this robe, this thing on me, and he presented me with those roses. And that was the first Miss Addison.
Oh, my goodness.
Isn't that something?
That is something.
We are just so happy you were able to do this with us.
I'm wondering what's in that book that I stuck. It was something. You want to open that, don't push it down there. And it's a great big, push it down.
Great.